Welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. I am your host, Aaron Erber. This is a podcast about stories, myths, and the Catholic faith. Hey everybody, welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies, and today we have a returning guest. She was on to talk about Dracula, and when we talked about Dracula, I hadn't finished it at that point. I have since finished it, and it's very, very good. And today, we're not talking about Dracula. Today we're going to talk about Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte, and to discuss this with me is Eleanor Berg Nicholson, and she speaks a lot about Gothic fiction, and she's also a big fan of Tim Powers, which is a huge, huge thing for me. when people even know who that guy is, you know, it's always good. So, Eleanor, how have you been since the last episode you were on?
Oh, very busy, but very well. Very busy.
Good.
Books, children, life.
Yeah. Yep. And I said before we started recording, I'm like, we're in the process of moving, so it's like we were showing the house this weekend, and we're doing photos today. So the last few nights, my wife and I have been up past midnight just trying to get things ready and done, and it's been stressful. But it hasn't been too bad. Like the kids have been good, which is surprising. Nobody's been like panicking.
Perfect. If you're sleep deprived, it's the perfect time to read this sort of novel.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of, it has some like almost hallucinogenic like qualities to it.
It does.
So yeah, it's been busy for me too. So I don't know with, I read Wuthering Heights for the first time this year. And like I was saying before we started recording, one of my good friends is also very literary, very well read, and my mother-in-law, who is very well read, both of them did not like Wuthering Heights, and they like for my mother-in-law, she said that it's one of the worst books she's ever read. She hates it so much, and I'm like, okay, I'm probably gonna like this book because we have different tastes in literature, and I'm like, okay, everybody's awful. And Tim Powers says this is one of his favorite books. So I'm like, okay, I'm probably going to like it. And I loved it. It's probably one of my favorite books now. And you had a video, it was very short, last year. Maybe I can link to it in the comments, where you briefly discussed Wuthering Heights. Can you just kind of go over that and how you first were introduced to the book, and then what's changed in your appreciation of it since then?
Totally. Well, I first read the book in high school. I was probably 13, and I hated it with all the passion that a 13-year-old literarily inclined reader can summon. It made me so angry. And I did not revisit it until college, and I read it as an undergraduate. And I could appreciate more of what was going on. But I can't say I enjoyed it. And then I read it in graduate school, and then I was absolutely livid because of all the things that my teacher said about it, because they were clearly wrong. It was just wickedly wrong, and it made me so angry. But I did a lot of fighting in graduate school. I did not spend a lot of time returning to it. I considered it a valuable novel, but like things like Robinson Crusoe, glad I've read it, can appreciate it, don't want to read it for fun. And then a couple of years ago, after teaching Jane Eyre, I teach, one of the things I do is I teach high school homeschoolers literature classes for Homeschool Connections. And I taught Jane Eyre several times. Wonderful response in the students. And I said, you know what we really need is a class, the Brontes. We should just do all three of them. We'll do all three. And so I said, we're going to read Jane Eyre, Wuthering Heights, and Tenet of Wildfell Hall. Mm. And I'm going to teach them together. Very challenging to do. And the previous year, I had taught Jane Austen, all of Jane Austen, including, I mean, down to her Juvenilia, unfinished works, and some of her letters.
Wow.
I read through that in two semesters. And it was so amazing, so beautiful, spoke to my soul. The students did so well. I thought, you know what? Counterpoint, got to do the Brontes, which meant I had to reread Wuthering Heights.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, all right, okay, and this time I'm going to lean on Joseph Pierce, who is one of the, possibly the greatest living Catholic literary scholar. Yeah, I'd say he actually definitely is. And so I thought, I'm going to read Joseph's introduction in the Ignatius Critical Edition, and then I'm going to reread it. And it was such a blessing because it gave me a few more pieces that I needed. Because I'd studied the Brontes, I'd studied Gothic fiction, I've clearly studied the Christian literary tradition, but he was able to put a few more pieces in place so that when I read it, especially as a 40-year-old, almost 40-year-old, looking at it very differently from a 13-year-old, my expectations were very different, I was able to read the novel, to value the novel, to see more in the novel. I would not say it is a happy book, and I would not say, I cannot say like you that it's one of my favorites, but a much higher value that I can now place on it. And even teaching it with the students, I believe, yes, they all agreed at the end that none of them would say it was their favorite of the three novels. However, they saw its value, and they were very glad that they had done the hard work of reading it and studying it. Which was very affirming because that, as a teacher, that tells me that, all right, I have figured out the right way to present this novel to a very challenging audience. I mean, there, it's a hard sell. If you can get high schoolers to value a novel that they don't particularly like, that's very satisfying.
Yeah. Well, how you present a book is so important because, like, my mother-in-law was talking to her about, my reading of Wuthering Heights and how Joseph Pierce's introduction to the Ignatius Critical Edition was so helpful, setting it up as like a fundamentally Christian story about damnation and hell and, you know, all that stuff. And she's like, if I had known that, you know, if I had known that perspective, I could appreciate it more, you know? And so I'm like, yeah, it's all about how you present the work, right? And how...
I think it's also how you are, you as the reader... are prepared to receive it.
Yeah.
So right. I present, my mother hates Wuthering Heights. She struggles with it, even though she can value it. And I said to her, well, read Joseph's introduction.
Mm-hmm.
And she did. And she said, that is so helpful. I'm going to try to read it again.
Yeah.
And then about, I don't know, a third of the way in, she said, you know what? This is not the time. I can't bear the heaviness, the darkness. I can't read this right now. And I said, well, then don't read it. Read it out or something quickly. But so it's partly, you have to be in a fit state. 13-year-old Eleanor was not in a fit state, although I value her experience of it. At this age, I was much better conditioned to read it. And I read it when I wasn't pregnant. I had a newborn, but I wasn't pregnant.
So yeah, that's important.
You have to evaluate.
Right.
I can read Tim Powers anytime.
Right.
I can read Woodhouse anytime. I can read Agatha Christie most of the time. Dickens, I can read anytime. Austin, I can read anytime. Wuthering Heights, conditions have to be right.
Right. Yeah. Well, what struck me is that it's I can see where Tim Powers gets a lot of his literary taste from. You know, he loves the Brontes. He loves, and I think Emily, I think he said it, that she's his favorite Bronte. And I can see it in his writing. I can see Emily's influence on him. Same with like, I haven't read Robert E. Howard yet, but he says Robert E. Howard's one of his favorite authors too. And you can see the Lovecraft influence on Powers and stuff like that. But like Emily Bronte, I was pretty surprised reading through this to see, oh yeah, I could see Powers really liking this because Powers, a lot of his books are like this.
Yeah, a little bit of a fever dream. The Anubis Gates.
It's yes.
A, oh, yep. It's such a thrilling, but insane.
Right. Beautiful. It's pretty and insane.
Crafted. I know one thing we'll talk about is the structure of Wuthering Heights because it's so heavily stylized and so structured. It's one of those clues to the reader, I think, that this is not just a story that you pick up and read and say, well, here's the narrative, boy meets girl. Oh, right. Everything's really bad. All right, ending.
Right.
No, but there is so much framing put in place mm-hmm. that you can feel Emily Brontë studying this and even studying the form of the novel. She's trying to do something very distinct. But if you go into it thinking it's just going to be, like I said, boy meets girl and things right. don't go well, it's going to be devastating.
Right, right. There's a lot of, like, the footnotes are very helpful in the Ignatius Critical Edition because they, you didn't edit this one, did you?
I did not write these footnotes.
Okay.
A lot of Joseph's footnotes in some of the other books I did produce.
Okay, right. But they were very helpful in, like, pointing out, you know, Shakespeare quotes and like mythological references that we can kind of talk about. So that was very helpful. And then one of the characters, Joseph, he's got this, I think he's Yorkshire. He's got a Yorkshire dialect that's very hard to read, but usually that's translated in the footnotes. And I'm very grateful for that because that kind of stuff would make anyone lose their mind if they didn't have that, like, how are you supposed to read this guy, you know? So
exactly. So in my classes, we always read aloud.
Yeah.
The classes I work in. And one of the points I put up a PowerPoint slide and asked for a volunteer. The students started and then said, Mrs. Nicholson, you gave me Joseph. You can read it. You can't even read it. I mean, it would be easier to read Villette by Charlotte Bronte and just read aloud the French. At least you could figure out maybe the rhythms of the speech with the Yorkshire dialect. In this one and in Bronte's Shirley, you get to those passages and you go, well, all right, I guess this is the part I skipped.
Yeah, skip. No.
I don't know what they're saying. I'm not sure if I even care right now because I feel so disconnected. But yeah, the footnotes, you need translations for Joseph.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. He's very difficult. That was the only sticking point for me was, I'm like, if I didn't have those footnotes, I could see people hating this book just for that reason alone. Because anytime you have like you're writing a dialect of a character, you're always going to run into, okay, people aren't going to be able to read this.
Yes. Well, but it also shows how closely united they were and how integrated the Brontes were into Yorkshire.
Yeah.
I mean, they were of Yorkshire. So when I, as a novelist, if I endeavor to take up a dialect, I can only go so far. I could not, you know, produce authentically an Appalachian dialect. I couldn't do it.
Right.
Because
right.
I couldn't speak it.
Right.
So I can figure out, the modulation of British Victorian tones that I can be from an extensive reading, not clearly because I'm not British or Victorian, but yeah.
Right. So right.
The degree of accuracy in Joseph, he feels believable, just comprehensible.
Yep. So, who was Emily Brontë? What was her background? She was a Parson's daughter, right? Like a Protestant cleric's daughter. What's her background? And was she a practicing Christian or I guess I'll just leave it open for that.
Well, I'd actually start with her father. Patrick mm-hmm. Brontë was, he rose from very humble, hardworking roots in Ireland. He was a laborer. He was a young laborer, but he learned to read. He was self-taught. And his path to a higher social level came when an Anglican cleric was passing a field, and he heard a voice, a young man, declaiming. He was performing one of the speeches of Satan from Paradise Lost mm-hmm. in a field. And the fellow said, good heavens, and plucked him out of obscurity and was able to give him a better education. This led to Brontë changing his name, leaving Ireland, leaving the Catholic faith.
Oh, interesting.
He'd been raised. And then he became a very staunch Anglican cleric and lived in Yorkshire for the rest of his life.
Wow.
And very dedicated at the parsonage at Haworth. He was there for the last 40 years of his life and served that parish. He and his wife had 6 children. But by the age of 6, Emily was their 5th. When she was 6, her sisters had died and her mother had died.
Mm-hmm.
So all that they had left were Branwell, one brother, her sister and her sisters, Charlotte, who was older, and Anne, who was younger.
Mm-hmm.
They were raised in the parsonage. Emily herself was very much a homebody, very dedicated to the household, to her father, to Christianity. She lived very quietly, seems very much introverted. She loved her dogs. She didn't talk to a lot of people. They had friends, but she was not social. Mm-hmm. She was not social, did not want to spend her time outside the home, or if she did, it was because she was walking the moors with her beloved dog, Keeper.
Hmm.
There's some very beautiful stories. We don't know a lot about her, but there are stories that capture her personality. And one is, there was a dog, possibly rabid, and she was not afraid of dogs. She actually broke up a mob of dogs. She would just go in and knock the dogs out of the way. Very much a dog lover, but unfearing. But this particular dog that might have been rabid bit Emily. So Emily hurried into the house, took a brand from the fire, and cauterized the wound herself.
Wow.
So it's very practical. But another way of capturing the personalities of these children, drawing from their father, is to look at their brother. Now, they were extremely precocious. They read extensively, deeply, deeply Christian, but also extremely well read, because Patrick Bronte, he not only took Milton and Paradise Lost, but he took the Romantic poets.
Mm-hmm.
So the children were deeply invested and acquainted with the Romantic poets. They were also heavily influenced, not just because of their father's former Catholicism, but because of Yorkshire itself. Yorkshire is the place where Catholicism lasted the longest after the Reformation.
Okay.
And there are elements that do not make sense in a Protestant understanding. The language of purgatory, purgation, even their interpretation of nature, human nature, and how it can be purified, not Protestant. There is no Protestant tradition that can support some of the things the Brontes work into their novels.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this twisted, bizarre, vaguely Catholic element. You see a lot more of this, of a sort of attraction-repulsion relationship with Catholicism in Charlotte. It's very articulated in Charlotte. But returning to the children, the way that they were raised, they were extremely creative, and they wrote stories together. So they had this huge imaginative world, really fascinating to read. Very beautiful, very influenced by myth and legend, but also those romantic poets. And she was attached to her brother, Branwell. Now, Branwell was a pretty pathetic human being. He was such a wannabe. He wanted to be a romantic poet. He wasn't a very good poet. He wanted to be a libertine. He wasn't a very good libertine, if he even was. He had a drug and alcohol addiction, and he died young, like all the Brontes did, all the Brontes except for Patrick Bronte. The father lived to be in his 80s.
Wow.
All of them died young. But there is one of the earliest descriptions that I ever heard of the sisters was that when Branwell came home drunk, Charlotte would lecture, Anne would cry, and Emily would put him to bed. And so one thing that when you read these books, especially when you encounter extremely dislikable and problematic male figures, abusive male figures, unhealthy male figures, there's a huge romantic influence. But also, I think there's this pervading concern of sisters to save the soul of their brother.
Interesting. Yeah.
They're worried about Branwell.
Mm-hmm.
I know something that Tim Power's upcoming book very much addresses. He has a novel that's about to come out, and it's about Emily Bronte and largely about Branwell, but it's through Emily's perspective. And it's her concern for Branwell, in spite of all the reasons why you'd really want her to say, "I'm sorry, punch this dude to the curb." Branwell is so problematic. He's not even likable. He's frustrating. His father mourned him when he died. They all died of tuberculosis, but he sure did his best to die of alcohol poisoning. You see his father mourning and want to say he wasn't worth it.
Yeah,
but of course, in a Christian understanding, the value that the sisters are placing on him is compelling and and deeply Christian.
Yeah.
So all of those are influences, I think, that are woven into Wuthering Heights and preoccupations that are woven into Wuthering Heights. And we can explore any aspect of them that strikes your interest.
Excellent. Yeah. So I guess we should dive into the novel. So what is the basic plot of Wuthering Heights? I mean, you have the manor, right? Wuthering Heights. And then what's the basic premise of the story?
Okay, the basic premise of the story is you have two households on this Yorkshire landscape, and they are sort of lower gentility. So you have the Earnshaws and the Lindens. And years ago, Mr. Earnshaw brought home this random gypsy boy named Heathcliff, and he introduced him into his household. He now, Earnshaw has two children, and the most important one is Kathy, the daughter. And the son, whose name is Hindley. See, there's the names have a lot of similarities, so if you're not careful, you can get tripped up.
Yep.
But Hindley hates Heathcliff. Kathy becomes very united to him as a child, loves him very deeply. But over the years, various people die. She ends up marrying the son of the other house, Edgar. But she, before she does so, she confesses how deeply, passionately, obsessively she loves Heathcliff. Heathcliff runs away, comes back rich, marries Edgar's sister. The marriage has all sorts of trouble, the marriage between Edgar and Kathy. Kathy dies mostly because she's consumed by her love for Heathcliff and has very bad notions of self-care. She destroys herself. Now, all of that has happened in the past. This is why I say the framing is so important.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's revealed over time. The actual narrative begins when Heathcliff has become the master of Wuthering Heights and owns the Grange, which was the Linton's home. And he's renting it to this not very likable man from London. Lockwood, this man, Mr. Lockwood, comes and he takes up residence in the Grange. And he's our narrator.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes, he wants to get to know his landlord. This is a super weird house. There are these super weird people living in it, and he's trapped in a snowstorm and spends the night there and is haunted by the ghost of Kathy.
Yep. Yep. One of my favorite lines in those first couple chapters when he's talking to Heathcliff, this Lockwood guy shows up to Wuthering Heights, so he wants to meet his landlord and stuff. And after like a few interactions with Heathcliff, he's like, "I'm beginning to think he's not a capital fellow," or something like that.
The understatement of the year.
Yeah, I'm like, that is like the biggest understatement ever.
Well, and then so Lockwood goes back to the Grange and starts talking to his housekeeper, who turns out to have been, thank heavens, the maid, Nellie, who was present, and she's the one who tells us the story.
Mm-hmm.
She tells a solid chunk of what happened 30 years ago and subsequently. So she tells about Heathcliff entering the household. She talks about how much the household is poisoned by his presence, of the relationship between Heathcliff and Kathy getting married, Kathy dying after giving birth to a daughter, Catherine. Some other points, Heathcliff's wife, who is Kathy's sister-in-law. I mean, this is a family tree that just collapses on itself.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of intermarriage, and that's an important point as well. The fruitfulness of the family dries up. Not only that, it's like it's corrupted. The tree is blighted. It cannot beget more. And that is the Heathcliff influence. He comes into it, and you'd think that the outsider coming into this pretty small society would be a healthy element. That's what you get in Jane Austen. The outsider comes in. Is he marriageable? No, Heathcliff comes in, and there's this poison that enters into the family tree. So he married Edgar's sister. He married Edgar's sister and had a child. But she ran away with the child because he was a monster. So she runs away. Years later, through the death of Edgar and various scheming machinations, Heathcliff gets control of young Catherine and of his son. And he says, I'm going to make them get married.
Mm-hmm.
So he various things. They are married. Then his son died. But now he has control. And he has control of one other person. Remember the brother of Catherine, original Catherine, we'll just call her Kathy, easier. The brother of Kathy hated Heathcliff and eventually came under Heathcliff's power and died as a desolate alcoholic. Mm-hmm. His son, Harriton, is under Heathcliff's sway as well. So mm-hmm. now he's got under his control the children of his rivals. The children of his rivals.
Yep.
And he is just dominating over them. And he's doing various things. He's making young Catherine miserable. He corrupts her mostly sunshiny personality. And she hates him. She hates everyone there. Mm-hmm. She is hateful, mistrustful, because she's been imprisoned in the Gothic household for, you know, some time now.
Yep.
But the irony is the son of his other rival, so Harriton, he's raising him to be illiterate.
Mm-hmm.
And to lower his social standing into the dust. But yep. he is worshipped by this young man.
Yep.
Worshipped by this young man. He has this absolute dog-like devotion to this monster. So Heathcliff has built all of this in, and Lockwood says, good heavens, what a dreadful place. I'm going back to London. He comes back 8 months later and hears again from Nellie Dean, oh my goodness, Wuthering Heights is a lovely place. Heathcliff's dead.
Yeah.
The demon is exorcised. Everything's wonderful. And I do hope the young people get married. And you have this beautiful significance. The blighted family tree has hope. And you know it because the young people are planting flowering bushes. They have roses. So actually, Wuthering Heights, which has been blighted, now sees new life. So there's this wonderful symbolic arc. But this thread of Heathcliff and his demonic, possessive love for Kathy still persists because there is a hint that their souls haunt the Yorkshire Moors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's as clear as a presentation of the plot of Wuthering Heights as I can give. But it's still, even as I say it, it's like I once said to Tim Powers, describing a plot in a Tim Powers novel, you come off sounding like you're insane. Wuthering Heights, it is not a clear boy meets girl trajectory. It's just tangled, 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 tangled. But when you get to the end, there's sunlight.
Right. And the end is very interesting because Kathy and Harriton, excuse me, they fall in love with each other. It takes a while because they both kind of hate each other, but Harriton is really attracted to Catherine, and he has a devotion to her. And she thinks he's just this rube, you know, illiterate and stupid, and she's very judgmental, but it's like, it's not Harriton's fault, right? Because he's been so manipulated by Heathcliff to the point where Harriton was supposed to inherit the manor. He was supposed to inherit Wuthering Heights, and he doesn't know that. He doesn't know. So Heathcliff had to do to manipulate him was just not tell him and keep him uneducated so you can't figure it out, you know? But the quintessential moment at the end when they dig up Joseph's like black currant, you know, his black currant tree, right, to plant their fruitful plants is very heavily symbolic of like, this renewal, this Edenic sort of symbolism where it's like this, they're starting again, creation begins anew, and they're hopefully going to be fruitful and continue the family line in a more healthy, even though they're cousins, technically. I mean, whatever. I think that was pretty common then, you know, to marry your cousin.
Well, and this is actually something that's a stumbling block whenever I teach, but also with Jane Austen saying, look, first cousin marriage was permitted, and actually it's still permitted in many places. The Catholic Church condemned it a long time ago, just saying for health, a lot of reasons, including health. But it was common. It was common at the time. It was common at the time.
Yeah. So no judgment here. I'm not judging the Brontes or anything, because I know that was very common. And I think the Catholic Church has condemned up to like third cousins. So you have to be like at least three or four removed before a marriage will be valid, which I think is pretty smart.
I think it's 6 points. I think third cousins makes it 6 point removed. I once, at a family reunion, we all sat down and we charted it. And we're like, hey, none of us can marry each other.
That's a relief. Whew. Yeah.
Our children could marry each other, though. That's really weird.
Yeah, that'd be weird. Yeah, no thanks. And Heathcliff, part of the reason I wanted to talk about this story, and I think it's connected to the themes of my show of like enchantment and fantasy and stuff, because Emily kind of weaves in these. I mean, there's ghosts in it. There's ghosts. There's a ghost of Kathy who shows up in the beginning and the end to have an effect on the story. And as I'm reading it, I'm like, this is, she incorporates a lot of fairy tale tropes into this too. Like Heathcliff, he's sort of this like quasi demonic sort of figure. And I think Chesterton said he fails as a man, but succeeds as a demon or something like that. And when I was reading it, I'm like, okay, this is like an anti-Cinderella story. Like in the original Grimm story, you have Cinderella, who is the son or the daughter of the father who in his first marriage, right? So she should be beloved, but she's not. She's despised and hated, especially when he gets remarried and has two other daughters. There's this, you know, she plants a, so the father goes to town, right? Like, okay, daughters, what would you like me to bring you? And the two stepsisters say, well, I want you to bring me beautiful gowns. And the other one says, I want you to bring me jewels. And then, Cinderella says, well, the first twig that hits your hat on the way home, you know, that's what I want you to bring me. Like this basically this like really passive aggressive, like, you don't care about me anyway, so just bring me whatever hits your head. And so it's a hazel branch, right? And he plants it and it turns into a tree, and then she cries under it and prays to her mother for help, you know. And with Heathcliff, it's the father says, okay, children, you know, Mr. Earnshaw like says, okay, I'm going to go to town. I'll be back in 3 days. What would you like me to bring you? And I can't remember what it was, but I think Catherine wanted a musical instrument. Hindley wanted something. And even Nellie got something like fruit, like pears and apples. And he comes home and he brings Heathcliff, and all their other gifts are either lost or destroyed, you know? And he devotes all of his attention and love to Heathcliff. This complete strange foreign influence, you know, on their family that, like, it makes no sense why. I mean, it's good that he has compassion on this poor little boy, you know? He's like 16 when he brings him home. But there's a scene, where he, after Kathy dies, Heathcliff is standing, I could read it. Heathcliff is standing under a tree. I gotta find out where that is. It's a really, he's standing and crying under a tree. Let's see. Gotta figure out where that is. sorry. Oh, there it is. Okay. 185. So, he's standing under a tree. And Nellie comes up to him and like to see how he's doing, mourning the loss of the person that he loves. He was there at least a few yards further in the park, leant against an old ash tree, his hat off and his hair soaked with the dew that had gathered on the budded branches and fell pattering around him. He'd been standing a long time in that position, for I saw a pair of ousels, which are apparently blackbirds, passing and repassing scarcely 3 feet from him, busy in building their nest and regarding his proximity no more than that of a piece of timber. They flew off at my approach, and he raised his eyes and spoke. So the blackbirds contrasting with the doves in this Grimm story, which is like the Holy Spirit. Blackbirds are this kind of ominous, you know, demonic sort of presence. She's dead, he said. I've not waited for you to learn that. Put your handkerchief away. Don't snivel before me. Damn you all. She wants none of your tears. And he said, so skipping ahead, yes, she's dead, I answered, checking my sobs and drying my teeth. Gone to heaven, I hope, where we may, everyone, join her, if we take due warning and leave our evil ways to follow good. So that's Nellie. She did take due warning then, asked Heathcliff, attempting a sneer. Did she die like a saint? Come give me a true history of the event. How did... And then he endeavored to pronounce the name, but he could not manage it, and compressing his mouth, he held a silent combat with his inward agony, defying, meanwhile, my sympathy with an unflinching, ferocious stare. How did she die? He resumed at last, fain, notwithstanding his hardihood, to have a support behind him, for after the struggle he trembled in spite of himself to his very finger ends. Poor wretch, I thought, you have a heart and nerves the same as your brother men. Why should you be so anxious to conceal them? Your pride cannot blind God. You tempt him to wring them till he forces a cry of humiliation. Quiet as a lamb, I answered aloud. She drew a sigh and stretched herself like a child reviving and sinking again to sleep. And 5 minutes after, I felt one little pulse at her heart and nothing more. And then he's skipping ahead a little bit more. Her life closed in a gentle dream. May she wake as kindly in the other world. And then Heathcliff says, "May she wake in torment," he cried with a frightful vehemence, stamping his foot and groaning in a sudden paroxysm of ungovernable passion. She's a liar to the end. Where is she? Not there, not in heaven, not perished. Where? Oh, you said you cared nothing for my sufferings, and I pray one prayer. I repeat it till my tongue stiffens. Catherine Earnshaw, may you not rest as long as I am living. You said I killed you. Haunt me, then. The murdered do haunt their murderers, I believe, and I know that ghosts have wandered on earth. Be with me always. Take any form. Drive me mad. Only do not leave me in this abyss where I cannot find you. Oh, God, it is unutterable. I cannot live without my life. I cannot live without my soul. And he dashed his head against the knotted trunk and, lifting up his eyes, howled not like a man but like a savage beast getting goaded to death with knives and spears. I observed several splashes of blood about the bark of the tree, and his hand and forehead were both stained. Probably the scene I witnessed with a repetition of others acted during the night. It hardly moved my compassion. It appalled me. Still, I felt reluctant to quit him so. But the moment he recollected himself enough to notice me watching, he thundered a command for me to go, and I obeyed. He was beyond my skill to quiet or console. So he is crying under this tree, and he's smashing his head against the tree in his forehand. In like this antichrist, you know, like the mark of the beast, against the tree, which the tree is kind of this connection between heaven and earth, and he's basically the anti-Cinderella and an antichrist figure.
and he's an absolute mess.
Yeah,
this actually strikes at the heart of people's misinterpretation. Certainly for mm-hmm. me in graduate school, but it's widespread. It's widespread in misinterpretations of this novel and of Emily Brontë, not trying to see in her some sort of proto-feminist or neo-Marxist. It doesn't right. make any sense.
No.
But the text and what we have of her just doesn't support it.
Right.
And I, anyone who tries to read this book as depicting a romance so deep and so incredible that it, you know, hearts are burst. Anyway, and they make film adaptations of Wuthering Heights, and they get it wrong over and over and over and over and over again. The famous Kate Bush Wuthering Heights song, it's supposed to be, it has elements of, it's an earworm from hell. If you haven't heard it,
I've not, no.
You will never escape from it, but famous, so famous that when they put special rocks near the parsonage and had people inscribe something memorable, famous people. Kate Bush was the one they asked to inscribe for Emily.
Wow.
Because of her book, Wuthering, or her song, Wuthering Heights. But it captures elements of the possession, but somehow tries to see in it love. Something
which is completely wrong. It's completely backwards. Like this guy, they're idols for each other. You know, they worship are. Each other. And this novel is about how damaging. Basically, idol worship is turning something into an idol and then like falling at your feet and worshiping this created thing. And that's why this is so twisted. And that's why when people I can kind of see where they're coming from a little bit with like the feminist piece, because, well, it's not 100% true, but like a lot of the men in here are cads, you know, but the women aren't great either. It's not like nobody's all that good in this novel, you know?
The thing that I think is, that is being really brought home, and the Brontës all did this to an extent, was looking very closely at the realities of relationships between men and women and identifying toxic, seductive but toxic traits. So more seductive possibly for Charlotte Brontë than for Emily, and definitely than Anne, because actually if you want to read the anti-Gothic novel, you read Tenet of Wildfell Hall, where the redeeming the rake, redeeming the cad, it's shown to be not possible. It's very tragic, very pragmatic. It's got its own sort of quirks, but the central plot there is a marriage between an abusive, depraved alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
And the narrator, well, or the protagonist, and she's only partly the narrator, and the collapse of that marriage and what it signifies socially and emotionally and psychologically for the wife especially. So here, though, you're seeing what possession looks like.
Mm-hmm.
I heard a priest say recently that if we look to Saint Joseph, he personifies love for all relationships, but he was speaking specifically for the priesthood. He said the priest is called to serve and love with his entire being that which he will never possess.
Hmm.
To love the family, like St. Joseph and the Blessed Mother, mm-hmm. to give his entire life, to spend his life in service and love and stewardship of the Blessed Virgin and our Lord Jesus Christ without any shred of ownership or possession.
Right.
And he said, actually, all relationships are called to be that way. Even marital relationships that are not, you know, virginal. But here, seeing that the possessive impulse of Heathcliff and the response from Kathy is not only psychologically, emotionally, physically destructive, but it is actually demonic.
Yeah.
And that is what is destroying the family. That is what elevates it to a gothic novel mm-hmm. on top of the ghosts, because it is showing, it's looking into the bowels of hell and seeing how it operates. This is one of the reasons why it was so frustrating for me in graduate school. I had one teacher who said, he was waxing eloquent. I thought he was going to faint. He was so overwhelmed with the beauty of it. But he said, well, but you have to understand, Heathcliff is only finally satisfied in his sexual yearning for Kathy in death when he is able to join her in her grave.
Yeah.
And he, until that moment, he is a virginal character. And I raised my hand and said, well, he sows his wild oats all over Europe, and then he begets a son. And he said, well, that doesn't count.
He has a son. What are you talking about?
I exploded. And I said, virginity is an actual physical fact. It is not some sort of vague feeling that I was so mad. And the teacher, he fought back. He was a good teacher in spite of being totally wrong about pretty much anything, because he would engage.
Right.
And he would respond to arguments. So he was fun to fight with.
Mm.
That's good. I have a deep affection for him. But would never want to be an undergraduate or graduate student again. But he was reading it wrong. It's sort of like taking a book, and if you flip the book upside down and cover one eye and try to read it backwards, you might get some of the words, but you're going to miss the entire point.
Yeah.
And you'd have to be reading it upside down with one eye closed, possibly with the book closed, to be able to get the interpretation that people derive from Wuthering Heights.
Yeah.
It's sort of like reading Romeo and Juliet and thinking it's pro-teenage romantic love.
Right. Definitely not.
It's not.
So they die at the end. It's a tragedy. Yeah. They kill themselves.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, Joseph Pierce is really wonderful in that respect as well, because he points out in his introduction to that one that the central tragedy in that story is the destruction of a child.
Yep.
The child is Juliet.
Yep.
So
Romeo is a complete cad.
He is. He's a predator.
And that's Heathcliff is too. He's this predatory figure who. Yeah. Like what I really like about Heathcliff as a character is he's so awful. There's no justification for his actions. He just there's a little bit where he, you know, he's taken in by Mr. Earnshaw, and everybody, like, Hindley hates him. And so Hindley becomes master of the house, and he treats Heathcliff like a servant, you know, beats him, you know, yes. just awful to him. And, but Heathcliff doesn't start off great either. You know, he's like, basically, he comes in and he's like 15 or 16, and he's this like gypsy boy, and his origins are completely unknown, other than the fact that Mr. Earnshaw found him in town, and he seems to be of gypsy origin, although that's not like completely clear, you know. They just see, like, it seems like he looks like a gypsy, basically, because he's got a darker skin complexion. And he leaves and comes back, and he makes all this money. And Nellie says, well, I don't know how he made his money. I don't know where he comes from. So,
yes.
you know, it, like, his origins are completely unknown, leading, like, kind of lending to this Antichrist sort of demonic sort of origin. Although he's still a man. Like, he's in the story, he's still a man, right? But he has this, like, this aura about him of the demonic. And where he marries Isabella, which is Edgar's sister, Isabella Linton. And he hates her. He despises her. And she's like, oh, he's so romantic. I she's got this complete, like, you know, that he's like this anti-hero sort of, like, he's probably got a heart of gold. He just has this gruff exterior. And Catherine's like, no, man, no. Like, he's awful. You do not want to marry him. He's really, really awful. And Catherine likes him. You know, she has this infatuation.
Well, she's attached to him. She has a deep attachment, but
she hates him too, kind of.
Like him.
Yeah.
But I think the Brontes actually, especially in this book, explodes the whole, I mean, we see it today. It's the bad boy, the sexy bad boy temptation.
Right.
It's like, no, you know, I'm sorry. Not only is Twilight bad writing, but it's deleterious smut. And if you're a teenage girl and you think you're going to make the boy in the leather jacket, you are going to change him.
Right.
You are missing a couple of screws in your brain.
Right.
And you need to, I don't know. You need to read Jane Austen for about 6 years and then be allowed to interact with society. In practical terms, he is toxic.
Yeah.
Toxic. As my students, they kept throwing up fake hashtags during class and they'd say, hashtag, they need therapy. Hashtag, Heathcliff is toxic. And it's true.
Yeah.
But all of his motivations are wrong.
Right.
Hindley beating him is wrong. It is horrible. It is dreadful. But every action that Heathcliff takes in his life is driven by envy and revenge.
Yep.
His motivations are demonic. He has given himself over to the darkest, cruelest of sins. Envy, too, is that it's the sin that has no joy because all you do is hate the other for having any happiness.
Right. Yep.
You don't, it's not that you want it for yourself, it's that you don't want that person to have it.
You
want to
destroy that. Yeah.
That's Heathcliff.
Yeah, definitely. And he's just this, you read Heathcliff and you're like, okay, how can anybody misinterpret what Emily Bronte is doing here? Like it's clearly, this is so destructive and he's such a demonic figure that I kind of get the feminist angle a little bit because the only other than the fact that he's a man, you know, and he's awful. So I can kind of see that a little bit. But then you have Edgar, who is the exact opposite in every way of Heathcliff and physically too. Edgar's more sickly, but he's pious. He's virtuous. He's a good man. He's like one of the only good men in the book.
I'd say Edgar's biggest issue is that he would have been better served to love a virtuous woman. He makes the opposite mistake.
Right.
She's beautiful. I love her. We'll have a happy marriage. Instead of, she doesn't actually exude the qualities I desire for a mother of my children.
Well, there was a scene where they were both younger and kind of courting. And Catherine, I forget what the circumstance was, but Nellie caught her lying. Catherine was lying to Edgar. And then Catherine was pinching Nellie really hard to get her to leave, you know, because Nellie was like, no, I'm just here cleaning, you know, I'm just in the room cleaning. She's kind of spying on them, you know, make sure that they don't to hear what was said and everything. I think she was doing it for Hindley or something. I can't remember.
She's also doing it because Kathy is breaking some social rules, and she's not protecting herself as a virtuous maiden.
Right. And Nellie is the virtuous kind of housekeeper, quasi-sibling to Hindley and Catherine. And Edgar's biggest mistake, like you said, he knows Kathy was lying to him. He knows she was abusing Nellie, basically, in front of him, you know? Yeah. And he's like, well, like he goes to leave, and then he has this sort of pity and he turns around and comes back, and then their relationship is cemented and they're going to get married, and then the tragedy will eventually happen. But it was his like turning around and saying, I'm going to ignore this, basically.
And it's also because primarily he is in love with, he's infatuated with Catherine.
Yeah.
And that shows his weakness, but a relatable weakness.
Yeah.
Relatable weakness. He's much more human than Heathcliff is able to be.
Right.
But I think too, on the feminist angle, it's important to note that before formal feminism arose, there were in literary circles, but also widespread, there were condemnations of bad behavior in men and in women. And there was a clear vision of issues in society, such as the fact that a woman could not, if she had a physically abusive husband, she could not actually be released.
Mm-hmm.
Only the husband could seek a divorce. for, and it cost a great deal of money. But then on the opposite side, No Fault Divorce is, you know, it's the wrong answer.
Right.
Or women being taken away from their proper domestic sphere and told you shouldn't have children, or you should only do it when you're much older. There's no happiness that way. You must pursue profession. Oh, so right. It's like the answers are all wrong. It wasn't a problem or that people didn't see it. Actually, right. One of the most notable moments in Tenant of Wildfell Hall, remember I said it's Anne Bronte's story of the abusive marriage, mm-hmm. is when the wife realizes that her husband is cheating on her.
Mm, okay.
And when he comes to her room that evening to cajole her and have his husbandly way, because he's a libertine, she closes she leaves the door locked.
Yeah.
She denies him his husbandly rights.
Mm-hmm.
That is huge. That is a huge moment in terms of responding to an abusive relationship. Someone described it as Anne Bronte's closed door echoes down through the ages. Bit of an exaggeration, and I don't think it's quite what Anne wanted, but the idea that a woman can say, no, I will not be treated in this way. So the Bronte's right. do have that preoccupation. I think when we say feminism, it has so much modern baggage with it.
Yeah, right.
But there would be a concern that Emily Bronte would say, abusive.
Right.
Unhealthy. Kathy's a terrible person too. Just that it's
right.
These are the family is twisted and tormented and requires redemption.
Right.
And since they have closed the door to Christ, and the only voice, Christian voice, that is coherent in this novel is Nelly.
Yeah.
It's only believable, trustable, non-hypocritical Christian voice. Interestingly, though, she is not the voice who begins and ends the novel.
Yeah.
It's Lockwood, who doesn't have the Christian vision, who doesn't understand the Christian vision, who is still left puzzling over the question, are they haunting the moors? Are Kathy and Heathcliff haunting the moors?
Right.
Are they trapped? Are they in heaven? Are they in hell? Are they in, we don't have purgatory, but are they in it?
Right. Right. Yeah.
It's like, what? And that's probably, in some respect, Emily Bronte's own struggle, because she does not want those tormented by ungoverned, undisciplined passions, potentially like her brother.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't want them to go to hell.
Right.
Even though she sees clearly that way damnation lies.
Right. And the ending is ambiguous as to Heathcliff's ultimate and Kathy's ultimate fate, because so toward the end of the novel, you know, everything is just, Heathcliff has complete control over everyone, you know. And there's a scene where he's like, and I'm healthy, you know, I'm fit, I'm hardy, I'm not dying anytime soon, basically. And everyone is just like, well, great, this is just going to be our lives now. And it's awful. Like, he imprisons Kathy too, you know, Catherine's daughter. And he makes Hareton illiterate. And Linton, his son, Heathcliff's son, that made me the angriest when he was very sickly. He's got tuberculosis. And he dies before he's 20. You know, he's very young. And he basically locks Kathy and Linton in a room and says, you are not allowed to leave until you are married. And Kathy says, well, my father, Edgar, is dying. I need to be with him. And he's like, good. I hope he dies without you, basically. Like, all the better, you know. And then, you know, he forces a marriage, which wouldn't be valid. But he forces the marriage. And then Linton's dying, right? Which is all part of the plan. You know, you want, like, this is perfect. He's sick, you know, and he's going to die.
I hate him
anyway. I hate my own son. And he's like, well, then since Kathy has no property rights, all the ownership will go to me, you know? And so Linton is dying, and Kathy, like, it's in the middle of the night, and she, like, we were just talking about this, like, with sick children, you know, in the middle of the night, it's really awful with throwing up children, and you want help, you know, and thankfully, most people aren't monsters, and so they're going to help you, right? Yeah. She goes to Heathcliff, like, your son is dying. He's dying. Go get the doctor. He's like, I'm not going to spend any money on a doctor for him. I hope he dies, basically. And then everyone is too scared of Heathcliff to help Kathy with Linton, who is dying, you know, and that was like, oh my gosh, Heathcliff needs to die. Like, that was.
What does Kathy say after that when she comes down after he's dead and she's broken?
Yeah, she's completely broken. Yep.
And she says, you've left me too long with death. the horror she is just
like, I am death now. Like I basically like I've seen too much. This has been so traumatic that you've basically ruined me. And that was Heathcliff's plan. He's like, good.
Yeah.
Like I want you nice and you're going to lock you. We're going to lock you in this room. You're not going to be allowed to do anything until one of us dies, basically. And
but notice too, though, that he wants to destroy. He wants to corrupt. He wants to. It's that envy.
Right.
I do not have what I desire. Even if I'd had it, it wouldn't satisfy me.
Exactly.
But I just desire you not to have happiness, joy, or eternity. I don't just want you unhappy. I want you damned.
Yep. Exactly. He wants to destroy their souls and send them to hell, you know?
I want you to become like me.
Right.
So, there's the devil as well. It's not, who is like God, but I want you to become me.
Exactly.
Misery loves company.
Yep.
But in the end, he is not able to crush it because Catherine's heart, like Hareton, yearns for love, not just romantic love, but love.
True love. Yeah.
For God. Yearns for God to be freed, the soul to be freed. And this is actually, Emily Bronte's most famous poem, and it's one that's completely misinterpreted. Mm. And I'll read part of it here because I think it speaks to many of the topics that we've discussed, including the accusations of feminism, et cetera, et cetera. People read the first stanza, they read it as, the free soul that is just breaking free of convention. But if you don't mind, I'll read it through the first two stanzas and then the last three stanzas to see what actually connotes freedom for Emily Bronte. No coward soul is mine, no trembler in the world's storm-troubled sphere. I see heaven's glory shine, and faith shines equal, arming me from fear. O God within my breast, almighty ever-present deity, life that in me has rest, as I, undying life, have power in thee. With wide embracing love, thy spirit animates eternal years, pervades and broods above, changes, sustains, dissolves, creates and rears. Though earth and moon were gone, and suns and universes ceased to be, and thou were left alone, every existence would exist in thee. There is not room for death, nor Adam that his might could render void. Thou art being and breath, and what thou art may never be destroyed. So think with young Catherine gazing at Lyndon dying, being trapped with death, and think about the way that death overshadowed the lives of the Brontes. Loss, death. There's a story that when an older sister, I think it was Mariah, when she died, their aunt made Branwell go in and gaze on his beloved sister and to say goodbye, and she was in his coffin and he was physically fighting, I can't, don't make me look at that, don't make me look at that. So they had a sense that of death being so close. And if you go to look at pictures of the parsonage, the graveyards next door might have been tending towards some of the unhealthy, lack of sanitation. Anyway, it was not healthy, and Patrick Bronte was concerned about lack of healthy conditions when his girls went away to school. But anyway, with this sense of death pervading and overshadowing their life, and death, being surrounded by death, but is death killing the soul? No, because of faith and that sincere understanding of God's presence. That is permeates Emily's understanding. And I think it's one of the reasons she was even able to write such a book.
Yeah.
But it was not that she was not enamored of Heathcliff. She was not a passionate advocate for Catherine Earnshaw.
Right.
She was not invested in, possessive, highly twisted, hypersex love. No, that's not what she's saying. That's the other thing, people. There's a new adaptation or movie about her coming out.
Great.
And all I thought was 30 seconds of a preview. I hate adaptations. I love to hate them. I passionately hate them. But this is just so idiotically poisonous. And it's about the unknown sexual license enjoyed by Emily Bronte. It's like, no, you're idiots. There's absolutely nothing to suggest that Emily Bronte was not anything but a devout, virginal parson's daughter who preferred the domestic sphere and who was incredibly well-read and articulate, but was not going out to social functions and then having you know, sexual affairs behind, I don't know, behind a hedge. But that's not who she is.
Gosh.
It's not right, who she right. is or who she would advocate being. And if right. you read Wuthering Heights and you don't get that, you're just, I don't know, just, maybe you need not to read Wuthering Heights because you're just hurting my heart.
Well, it's like pearls before swine. Don't cast pearls before swine, right? It's because they'll devour the pearls and they'll devour you. And a lot of people who read any book, like, it's the same with any author who has a kind of a traditional sort of Christian mindset that also is a very good author, right? Modern people tend to project themselves onto the book and they don't have the, I don't know, theological or literary training or whatever to maybe they have too much of that. I don't know. they can't read it and get what the author wanted to them to get out of it because they're so preoccupied with their own fetishes.
Well, and that's exactly what it is. And when I was in school, I remember getting so frustrated because it was drummed in so much, you'd start to read something and then you would anticipate all the toxic, revolting things that they were going to read into it.
Right.
And sort of repurifying and disciplining the intellect so that you are not anticipating what they're going to see.
Mm-hmm.
And picking up on all of the bad interpretations that they're going to put into a work. It took me a while to work myself back out and discipline and purify my imagination so that I could read things purely
right.
again, and to be able to encounter novelists like Emily Bronte without, you know, getting my shoulders back saying, oh no, here it comes.
Right.
when that particular teacher went, well, and this necrophiliac consummation, and I went, are you thinking this is good? You think that Emily Bronte's trying to show some sort of romantic satisfaction? Do you not see this is speaking of demons?
Right. Heathcliff jumps in her in Catherine's grave, digs her up, and like, I don't know what he does, but it's not good. Like, it's really, really shocking and disturbing because he in no way can anyone with a sane and healthy imagination in any way interpret that as anything other than this is completely bonkers. Heathcliff is demonic and this relationship is toxic.
Well, like my students kept saying, they went, wait, he did what to the... He did what?
Yeah.
Holy grave robber! I mean, someone, please, could you call the police? Could
right.
This is illegal. This is wrong. This is unsanitary.
And if she's cold, then I'll just think it's the north wind making her cold, you know? And I'm like, oh my gosh! This guy's nuts!
Not even therapy. Maybe just lock him up.
Yeah. He should not be... No, he needs to be in prison. Like, there's so many moments where I'm like, this guy... Like, one of my favorite scenes was when Edgar punches him in the throat, you know? And I'm like, good, finally. It doesn't happen soon enough, but he finally punches him. And then Edgar leaves and go get some pistols and men, you know. and then Heathcliff ducks out of there really fast, you know. I think he breaks the door open, you know, because like I think Kathy locks the door or something. And she's like, okay, you guys need to work it out because Kathy wants to be married to Edgar, but also to have Heathcliff in their lives. And Edgar's like, this isn't going to work.
Yeah. It's marriage 101.
Right.
Marriage 101.
You can't have infatuous relationships with other men when you basically worship them and be married to someone else. It doesn't work.
Yeah, exactly. Someone else. And yeah, it's just he is this poisonous demonic influence. You mentioned that he then inherits the property. He inherits mm-hmm. both properties. He's like, I'm going to have it all. And in that respect, reading it through all these lenses, it's a very rich, very fascinating novel. Again, it's not a happy novel.
No.
It's not happy.
The ending is good. The ending is hopeful, right? Then that's good. That's if the ending wasn't hopeful, I don't think I would have liked it as much, but Wuthering Heights starts off with all this hellfire imagery, right? All this hell imagery, especially when Lockwood is first showing up, you know, there's all these thorns around the manor and like griffins and like dancing naked people on the outer wall and stuff and maybe not
and
dancing, but
there's writing above the door, like the entrance into hell.
Yep.
Joseph Pierce has a compelling suggestion that not only Milton is an influence here, but Dante.
Yeah, I could see that for sure. Yeah, I read that in his introduction. It was very compelling. Obviously, she probably knew about Dante. Milton obviously is a huge, like, Heathcliff is kind of like Milton's Satan, but like, but a lot worse, like, because there's nothing sympathetic about Heathcliff.
And you know, that's also a deliberate romantic misinterpretation of Milton.
Yeah, right, right.
There's that famous line from William Blake where he says, the reason that Milton wrote in chains when he wrote of angels and God was because he was of the devil's party and
right.
didn't know it.
Right.
In fact, if you look at Milton's theology, the reason that Satan is compelling and articulate and charismatic and sympathetic is one of the, it's like the marks of the beast. These are tells. This is how you know he's Satan.
Right. And he's also insane. Milton's Satan is insane. Yeah. You know, you're supposed to be like, I think you're supposed to read that and go, hey, I'm starting to sympathize with Satan here. That's not good. You know, and like, you know, it's a literary trick that Milton was doing to kind of like get you, make you aware of, I shouldn't sympathize with the devil, like the Rolling Stones song, you know, like sympathy for the devil. Like, that's not what we should be doing.
No. And also, too, remembering that for Milton, in his theology, a kind of watered down, maybe a little dull God and boring angels, that totally suited him. He was very, 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 very much not interested in a Catholic sensibility, shall we say.
Right.
Pretty much the opposite.
Yep.
So the romantics are being provocative when they read Milton and say that he wanted this and this is what we wanted. This is how we find perfect romantic expression for our souls, the soul of the poet, which is the greatest thing since sliced bread. And the Brontes read this, but they also recognized the torment, the tussle inside the human soul, even in the romantics, and they engaged in it. So they weren't just, oh, we love the romantics, they're the best. They were recognizing that lived out, those principles were so dangerous.
Right.
And unstable. So reading the Brontes, I feel as if it requires, it inspires reading more.
Yeah.
And that was another point that really distressed me in graduate school, especially when I realized how many graduate students not only hadn't read Shakespeare, hadn't read Milton, hadn't read Dante, didn't really read much in the Bible, but didn't care to.
Right.
And my argument was, I had one teacher, I loved her dearly, but she said, working with me on something, she said, I've never read the New Testament. This is so interesting. And internally I thought, you've written books on Charlotte Bronte. And you haven't read the New Testament?
Oof.
The language is just everywhere. You can't read the Brontes without saying, oh, and here comes the Bible.
Right, right. You need to be,
myth.
It's crazy.
And fairy tales and, you need all of that knowledge, and it helps with a good edition that has good footnotes, but it just inspires you to read more, to experience what the Brontes were reading.
And that's why Tim Powers thinks she's so compelling, and I agree, because Powers does the same thing. He incorporates all sorts of literary traditions, and he reinterprets the romantic poets to be basically possessed by vampiric Nephilim spirits or whatever. But it makes you want to... reading him makes you want to go... Like, I did a lot of research on Egyptian mythology after I read the Anubis Gates to prepare for that episode. And I'm like, yeah, it's all here. Like, he incorporates all of this stuff into the Anubis Gates. And it's almost overwhelming how much he puts into and synthesizes things and makes it coherent in his novel. It's amazing.
And also the funniest thing about Powers is that reading his books and you come across something and say, wow, that is so insane, dreamed up by Tim Powers. And then you find out that was one of the facts.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that actually did happen to Kim Philby. You know, it's like
definitely in Declare, and you go, is such a. I mean, he's such an incredible novelist. But reading along and saying this is insane. Wow.
Yep.
What fever dream inspired this? And then saying, wait a second.
The actual events of history. Right.
that's even creepier.
Yeah. Yep. Well, like the fact, so going back to Milton, I don't know if it was in Powers or not, or maybe Christopher Rocchio said something about this on Twitter, but Milton was starting to go blind by the end of his life, I believe.
Yeah.
It was either Powers or Rocchio who said maybe he was possessed by the Nephilim spirit too, because that was one of the marks of that, where the poets start to lose their virility, you know, their like potency, they can't reproduce anymore, they can't have children. And they lose their eyesight. They start going blind. And so I'm like, that's really interesting. And like, you read Powers' books, you're like, yeah, this stuff is real, man.
And all you have to do is, Branwell Bronte, too, all you have to do is imagine not just the romantic influence, but how much toxic drug and alcohol, the stuff they're putting in, and it all works together.
Right.
So there's a symbiotic relationship between unhealthy, unwholesome living and demons.
Yeah.
One of the things that Catholic understanding permits us still to have. Mm-hmm. This is one of the reasons that I love the Gothic genre, because we can play with these things. It's one of the reasons I write in the Gothic genre, because you can play with all these elements, even with a modern audience, because they're inclined to say, well, it's Gothic, that's why you have all that stuff.
Right.
But saying, no, I'm actually describing something that is closer to reality than so many books today. Is closer to reality than so many really lame, uninteresting works in the modern era.
Right.
And Emily Duncan too. I mean, what she's describing with Heathcliff, he's inhuman. He's inhuman, and yet he is human.
Right.
And while I might not have met a Heathcliff, I've met many who are shadows of him.
Right. Right. Well, and Branwell, like, there was theories that the Heathcliff is based off of Branwell, but actually I think it's Hindley who's based partly off of Branwell Bronte, right?
Probably.
Yeah,
probably.
Because he becomes a hopeless alcoholic, and there's insinuations that Heathcliff actually murdered him, right, when he was in a, because he was like destroying himself with alcohol by the end, and he was plotting with Isabella. Isabella didn't want to do it, but and she didn't end up participating in it, but he was plotting to kill Heathcliff. And then Heathcliff, there are, you know, rumors in the novel that Heathcliff actually murdered Hindley at the end, like suffocated him or whatever, like put him out of his misery. Which also lends this, you know, villainous, Heathcliff's obviously the villain, but it makes him even worse. He's a murderer too, maybe, you know, he's a psychologically and physically abusive. He's conniving and demonic and probably a murderer, you know, like, who knows?
Well, but it also makes sense that the Branwell connection would not necessarily go towards Heathcliff, because Heathcliff is, until he's sort of eaten alive from the inside by his own evil and possessiveness, he has agency. And Branwell Bronte was not very good at anything.
Right, right.
At all. He claimed to have been thrown out of his employment as a tutor because he had claimed to have had an affair with the mother of the house.
Oh, great.
But then later in life, when he tried to say, well, now your husband is out of the way, won't you take me back? If he'd even had an affair, and reportedly she said, no, loser.
No, thanks. I'm good.
I mean, he lost job. I mean, he was really a tragic fellow. Convinced he was a genius, and a genius who'd somehow been slighted by fate. The agency and aggression of Heathcliff would have been very much lacking in Branwell.
Right. Well, then, so the end of Wuthering Heights is very kind of surprising, because you get the ghost in the beginning when Lockwood is is one thing that makes it. Sort of like hell is the lack of hospitality. There's no place to sleep, you know? So like Lockwood, like, I need a bed. And they're like, well, we don't have one. And it's like, well, it's snowing outside, I can't leave. Like, oh, whatever. Like, good luck. So he finds this bed that was, Catherine's bed, I think. I can't remember now, but,
And that's where he actually reads materials.
Right.
This is what inspires his dream. He reads basically a diary of young Kathy. So it gives him a window into this past, which is only then unlocked when he talks to Nellie.
Well, then the ghost of Kathy visits him and asks to be let in, right? And he's like, nope. And then
he's read Dracula.
Right. Well, it's that trope, right? Like this, like, you don't, like, they want it, they can't enter unless you let them. Right. So, and then Heathcliff comes in the middle of the night, and he's like, no, come in. I want you here, you know? And then after that, when Lockwood returns 8 months later, you know, after all the narrating and stuff is done and you get the whole backstory of what happened, he comes back and he finds out that, shortly after that, Heathcliff stops eating. He stops sleeping, and it's because people think that he is being visited by the ghost of Catherine in the house, and preventing him from hurting her daughter anymore, which is good. But also, he's like, there are moments where he's like happy, but it's like a demonic sort of happy, you know, where Nelly looks at him and she sees a goblin smiling back at him, at her, you know, really creepy. And he's like, he's not interested anymore in torturing the children of his enemies. He's like, and he talks about that. He's like, I don't feel the need for revenge anymore. And I don't know why, you know, and Nelly's like, you need to eat something. He's like, yeah, I will. I'm going to eat it right now. And he sits down. He's like, well, actually, I can't eat this, you know? So, and then he slowly wastes away and dies because the ghost of Catherine is like preventing him from eating and like distracting him. And he's fixated on her completely, you know, when he sees her. And if that's even what's going on, you know, it's very like, she does a very good job of like, is that what's going on? You know, is that what's happening? And then he dies in his bed with the window open in the same bed that Lockwood stayed in, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, really. And he, like, Joseph, the very pharisaical, hypocritical Christian character, comes in. He's like, oh yeah, he's in hell. The devil took his soul away, in his Yorkshire accent or whatever. Like, yeah. The devil harried his soul away. I don't know. I can't do it. But
it probably sounds like the devil did.
Yeah. Well, do you ever watch the show King of the Hill?
No.
There's a character in that show. It's a cartoon. It's made by the same people who did Beavis and Butthead. and there's a character in that. His name is, what's his name? Boomhauer. And he's got this really thick Southern, like, kind of, like, accent. You can't understand anything he says, right? So it's real. But all the other characters know exactly what he's saying. And he's a funny character. But that's what Joseph kind of reminds me of. It's like everybody knows what he's saying most of the time, but the reader doesn't, you know? So he comes in, he's like, he's in hell, obviously, you know, Heathcliff went to hell. And then Nelly's like, well, I hope not. I hope he's at peace, you know, but we don't know. Yeah, that's the thing.
Which I think the ambiguity is partly because it's gothic fiction.
Yeah.
So that's one of the elements of gothic fiction, is that the threat or the catalyst is otherworldly.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's completely explained away, then you're in a different genre.
Right, right.
A genre that played with the trappings of the gothic, but then moved away from them.
Mm-hmm.
But you can see that in this respect, that she leaves it an open question. And that's also a Christian understanding that, well, I hope not. I hope he's at peace. Nelly praying for the soul of Heathcliff is the Christian call, because we do not know.
Right.
The final decision of God for any soul. So it's the reminder of Christian charity, even though the case is pretty compelling. They vote on what they think happened to Heathcliff. And they're like, hell. But if you say, what happened to Kathy? They go, I don't know.
Yep. No, no. Because she expresses more repentance on her deathbed. And Heathcliff says, I repent of nothing. You know, I'm not repenting at all. You know, I regret nothing, basically. Which is like, that's not a good way to die, you know?
not for any of us.
No. So, Lockwood leaves, you know, wondering if Heathcliff and Nelly, not Nelly, Heathcliff and Kathy are haunting the moors and haunting Wuthering Heights. Because after that, everyone moves to Thrush Cross Grange?
Yes.
The other property, and then they basically board up most of Wuthering Heights, and Joseph is left there to kind of take care of what's left, which is very fitting for Joseph, because he is kind of he's a terrible character too. He's quick to condemn, but very slow to help.
Well, and remember too that those final words, they do come from Lockwood. So that description, the question mark, is in a man who is not a believer.
Right.
He doesn't have,
that's a good point,
Nelly's Christian vision. And, I think that it's Emily Bronte clearly wanted it to be a question mark, because she could have made Nelly the narrator. She could have given a very concrete, very preachy Christian understanding and explained it. But she didn't want that. She didn't want that. There's she's capturing something which is challenging to read. I feel a degree of laughing. A sympathy with an early reviewer who said, read Jane Eyre as often as you like, but fly from Wuthering Heights like from a pest house. Like, what is this novel? And so, but if you read it with a Christian understanding, and you read it with a sense of the gothic and a sense of the life of Emily Bronte without an expectation of romantic catharsis,
right,
you're not going to get it. You will see much richness here.
Yeah.
Just don't anticipate it's going to be a walk in the park.
Right. It's a very brutal book. I was shocked at the brutality of Heathcliff, honestly, for that writing in that time period. You know, I'm like, this is something that, you know, this is even by today's standards, like Heathcliff is, you know, depicted very like he's just a really villainous character, and it's very, he's very brutal. Like, he's psychologically torturing his own wife, you know, on purpose to make her as miserable as possible, just because she's related to someone that he hates with a passion, you know, because Edgar's took Catherine from him. And so he's going to torture the mother of his child. He's going to torture his child. That was his treatment of Linton. Linton is really whiny and terrible too, but he's like the sickly kid who could have had a good life living with Edgar, you know, but Heathcliff's like, nope, he's my son. He's going to stay with me. And then he basically forces him to court Kathy, the younger Kathy, to the point where he's exhausted and sick. You know, he can't do it. And he's forced to put on a smile and like, oh, I feel fine. And everyone's like, no, you're dying. And like, don't send me home without coming with me, because Heathcliff will kill me, probably literally, you know. So it's like, yeah, really terrifying. Like, what a terrifying household to live in. And then when he finally dies, when Heathcliff finally dies, I'm like, finally.
The demon is exercised. The demon is exercised.
Finally, he's dead. And I'm like, it's good to hate a villain. You know, it's like, you don't get many villains that it's like, I just hate, like in Perelandra, C.S. Lewis's Perelandra, the Unman, you know, this demonic character. And like, Ransom goes on this like, kind of like soliloquy about, it's actually good to hate this creature. Like, it's good, this pure hate, you know, and I'm going to beat the crap out of this demon, you know? And I'm like, yeah, that was very satisfying. You know? So it's very similar. Like, you can't, like, you, it's like, there are very few villains nowadays where it's like, they're both compelling as a character and completely evil and you hate them. And you're not sympathetic with them hardly at all, you know? It's hard to do that, I think, and make a compelling villain.
So. And not come off with a caricature.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Because Heathcliff is a person. Like, he's a fleshed out character. You know, he's very interesting character. He's got a lot of good lines. You know, and but you hate him.
Yep.
Anything else? So I think we're kind of running up to the time here. Any other thoughts about Wuthering Heights? Thank you for talking about this with me. I know you're really busy, and it was kind of we had to reschedule once or twice, but this has been a lot of fun. So any final thoughts?
If you read it with faith as your guide, and maybe not at night. And two, as soon as you can, obtain your copy of Tim Power's new book, My Brother's Keeper, which will be out this fall, and it's absolutely incredible. He has done it yet again.
Yep, I'm excited for that.
Read them back to back, in fact.
Yeah, well, I'm hopefully going to get my copy soon, but the Ignatius Critical Editions of Wuthering Heights, I would recommend that one. It's really good. You get all the footnotes. You get Joseph Pierce's kind of introductory explanation of the book, and there's a bunch of, it's like three essays in the back that are really solid, like good pieces of literary criticism, kind of going through the different interpretations of Emily Bronte and kind of debunking those. And providing a lens on how to read Wuthering Heights. And I'd hesitate to say it's a wonderful story, but because
it is a beautiful story. It is a compelling, and it is a true and rich and fascinating story.
It is.
It's just not happy.
No. In the end,
happy. What did Jane Austen say of Pride and Prejudice? It is too light, bright, and sparkling. No one would say anything like that about Wuthering Heights.
See, I've not read any Jane Austen, so it'd be interesting to compare the two. Emily Bronte, because this is like, this is gothic to the extreme, man. It's like really.
And Jane Austen is the opposite.
Yeah.
Aristotelian clarity. I find that people are divided into two camps. They are the Austen lovers and the Bronte lovers. I am an Austen lover. If I had to choose, I'd be an Austen lover, but I have a deep love of the Brontes too.
Yeah.
So I perhaps I'm an ambassador between the two.
to warring camps. Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you, Eleanor. This has been really fun. And you have books as well. You wrote A Bloody Habit and Brother Wolf, which I have not read, but I plan on doing that whenever I get a spare moment. But I do want to read that.
Read My Brother's Keeper first. It also has werewolves.
They both have werewolves. Yes.
It's a werewolf club over there.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Sounds good. Well, thanks for coming.
Take care. God bless. Have a good day.
Thank you for listening to this episode of I Might Believe in Fairies. Please leave a rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Please follow me on Twitter at Aaron Erber and like me on Facebook. If you're excited to see where the podcast is going and want to offer some support for the project, you can find me on Patreon. Music is by Alexander Nakarada, and podcast art was designed by my wonderful sister-in-law, Linnea Kisby. Until next time, talk to you soon.